the goal today is to get on to discuss cohomology, but before we get there, let me just write down some of the formal properties of the wedge product. Just quickly. It's distributive. This if, excuse me, omega 1 is a K-form, and omega 2, omega 3 are both L-forms. It's associative. And three, it's U commutative. Where omega one is a K form. And omega 2 is an L form. So I thought I would mention these properties because I thought they might be familiar to you guys from a different context. If you're studying the path integral with fermionic fields, when you multiply fermionic fields, they satisfy these same properties. For example, this property here, that these anti-commute, is tied up with the Pauli exclusion principle, that if you know, omega, which omega is zero, if we're related to the fact that I can't have two fermionic states, the state is filled by a single fermion, and I can't put another one there. Well, let's move on to the Durham operator. So in coordinates, this is a map. It takes a K form to a K plus one form. And in coordinates, P of F I 1 K X I 1 A is equal to the F E X J EXJ wedge XI1 wedge DXIK. So where, as usual, we're summing over J with the summation convention, and this expression might have to be rearranged to put them in the correct order if it's not in the correct order. And we'll pick up a sign. So for example, in two dimensions, I can take F1 dx1 plus F2 dx2 g is equal to minus df1 dx2 dx1 dx2. And I picked up the minus sign because I had a dx2 and I moved it past. Plus df2 dx1 dx1 which dx2. So let me list some formal properties of the Durham operator and how it relates to the wedge product. But we won't prove everything because it's very elementary. Properties. One. So the Durham operator applied to a wedge has this kind of derivation property. Where omega 1 is a K form, omega 2 is an L form. So I pick up a sign when I move D past omega 1. So D, and these expressions, you always get a sign of minus 1 to the KL, the minus 1 to the product of the degree. And the operator D is viewed as of degree 1. Maybe I will leave this one as an exercise because it's easy. It's also when I actually wrote up notes this time, which I sent to Giuseppe. So the proof is in the notes. And the more important property is that D of omega is equal to. Let's prove this one. So we can assume omega looks like this. So d omega is df dx j1 and d of d omega is, I just apply the same formula. I'm going to differentiate twice. So now we just look at the first part. This piece here is symmetric in J1, J2. Whereas this piece here is anti-symmetric. Therefore, the sum is zero.
Question. Sudden, I'm just recalling from some calculus course I did earlier. The partial derivative commute only when your domain is simply connected or something, right?
No, the partial derivative is always commute because it's you can check this in a local patch.
Okay.
So there could be something you're thinking of which is related to the discussion of cohomology. Is that it's like if I defining an antiderivative?
I don't remember. Maybe I remember it wrong.
Something. Yeah, is this, are you maybe
Schwarz lemma or something? Like when you can swap the partial derivatives? Yeah, that means I thought there was some condition which is usually satisfied in physics, only then you can swap the partial derivatives. I mean,
if f is a smooth function, there's no problem. So I think there are conditions about the regularity of the function.
Okay.
But I thought maybe don't quite recall.
Yeah, I'll check it later.
Yeah. Okay, so, and now we know that the Durham operator. So let me briefly try to explain why, if you work in three dimensions, you learn this as an undergraduate. One forms are the same as vector fields. This is true anytime I have a metric, I can raise and lower indices. So this gets sent to fi ui dx j, and here's my metric tensor, I'll write it out, which you can take to be delta ij if you want. Let me just write this delta j, I'll use that. Two forms, this is special to three dimensions, and we mentioned it yesterday, are also the same as vector fields. And the way it goes is f I j dx I watch dx j gets sent to f I j u I dx k epsilon I j k. So if you think about it, what we're using here is not so much the metric as the volume form on R3 to translate a two form into a vector field. So if we do this transformation, then the Durham complex like this, well, zero forms and three forms are scalar. So we can translate this into just functions. Vector fields, scalars, and in this guy line we have the Durham operator. You can ask what does this correspond to in the bottom row, and what it corresponds to is something pretty familiar. Here is grad, here is curl, here is div. So the familiar operations from undergraduate calculus are simply the Durham operator in this special case. So I want to check all the cases. I think I wrote down all the things in my notes. The ones where you relate div and grad are really, really simple. Let me explicitly check the one of the curl. Suppose I take this guy. Fi dx I gets sent to del fi del x j dx j wedge dx I. New blackboard. Now, if we translate this into a vector and this into a vector, fi dx I corresponds to fi d by dx I, d by dx j delta j, and xi, this corresponds to the vector epsilon ki df I dx j by dx k. So once I've translated into vectors, the Durham operator sends x j delta I j to epsilon k I d f I x j by d x k. And if I bring this guy, the delta I j, to the other side, This is curl. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
Is the title just based on the anti-symmetry or variables? Yeah, just the fermions. Where do the fermions come
from? Oh, that wasn't meant to be a title. It was meant to be at the end of the. So, but I'm saying it's reminiscent of fermions because we can treat these DXIs, they're Grassmann variables, like anti-commuting variables. So a differential form is, it's like a field which depends on n bosonic and n fermionic. So far we've known that there's no serious connection with fermions. I mostly wanted to mention that just in case you guys are already familiar with the algebra of anti-commuting variables.
Also, this vector space span the Fokker space of fermion, right? Because with tensor product and anti-commute, so it's exactly the same thing.
Yes, exactly. So from that picture, you might think of a quantum mechanical system with 2n fermionic operators, n of which are raising and the other n are lowering, and that we obtain the Durand complex by hitting a vacuum state with the raising operators, which are the dx's. And the coefficient f, those are the usual bosonic Fock space. So this whole the space of differential forms is the Hilbert space of a certain quantum mechanical system. If you ask what quantum mechanical system, it's a system with supersymmetry, and the Durand operator is one of the supersymmetries. So this was exploited by Witten in the late 80s. Now we have some understanding of the Durand complex. It's a complex, that means that's a word for saying when the d times d is zero. When that condition holds, mathematicians call it a complex. So I want to discuss Durand cohomology now. Now, at least introduce it. We're not going to be able to understand too much about it, but I can still write down the definition. If M is a manifold, we define the kth Durand cohomology group. It's going to be a quotient. So the set of forms in omega km would satisfy d omega equals 0. So this condition means omega is closed, monology. I'm going to divide by an equivalence relation. So I'm going to ask that two closed forms give the same element here. They differ by d of something. Omega tilde omega prime. If omega minus omega prime is equal to d eta, for some eta and omega k minus 1. Right, so it's the collection of forms which are closed modulo those, or we identify two forms, their differences of this form is d of something. We noticed that for this definition to make sense, you have a question?
No.
For this definition to make sense, it's necessary that d of eta is zero. Okay, so are there any questions about this definition? Yeah?
Maybe also for a later point, but we saw something very similar in our QFT3 course.
Uh-huh. Oh.
Looking at the physical Hilbert space.
Uh-huh. The VRST operator?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know whether we can maybe talk about the connection. Perhaps also after.
Uh-huh. There's not an easy connection. The truth is this construction appears like everywhere in math and physics, where you take some operator satisfying d squared equals zero and you take its kernel and modulo the image. This is called cohomology, it just appears everywhere.
Are you saying the cohomology part refers specifically to precisely the recipe you just gave? Take an operator, take the kernel, modulo the image.
Yes. That will give me. Exactly. So the word cohomology is a little bit overloaded. So it's used in both algebra and geometry. So in algebra, it's like if you have a sequence of linear maps where the composition of two of them is zero, you do this algebraic operation. That's called cohomology. And in geometry.
Oh, so that's also the link between an exact form and an exact sequence.
Exactly, yeah. Well, you've seen exact sequences in other contexts?
Just bread.
Okay. We were going to come to them eventually. but in geometry, the cohomology of the manifold is the cohomology of this particular protein complex, forms and Durham operator.
So, is this cohomology something more general than cohomology is one of the cohomologies, or the same thing?
That's a really good question. So in people, the Durham cohomology is one of the methods of computing cohomology with coefficients in the real numbers. You can also consider cohomology with coefficients in the integers or the rationals. And then if you do that, you need something a little bit less based on calculus. So it's people normally use a different method to compute.
So by coefficients in R, what do you mean? Coefficients of?
Well, so for you notice that if I can take real linear combinations of forms, I can multiply them by a real number. But there's other cohomology theories where I can only multiply them by an integer.
And usually, I don't know, the definition I had heard was forms which are but not exact from the cohomology.
That's a kind of a shorthand way of saying we're saying closed modulo of exact. In closed forms where we throw away the exact ones.
Okay.
Like we're setting the exact ones to be zero. Yeah, so let's get a feel for why. Cohomology groups are topological invariants. They're the most basic topological invariants. And the Betti numbers are the dimensions of these vectors. And you can build all kinds of crazy spaces where these Betti numbers might be infinity, but for any kind of reasonable manifold, be fine. Let's do, what was I? Not too far. So, as a very first example, what is the cohomology of the wheels? And if we want the cohomology to be an interesting topological invariant, the wheel numbers are not an interesting manifold. So we better hope that this is kind of boring. And it is. So let's compute it. So a zero form, these are functions. F of x. One forms are things like g of x dx. So let's first consider the cohomology with the zero forms. So I have a zero form x, f of x, and the derivative is just df dx dx. So for a zero form to be closed, this constant quantity must be zero. A closed zero forms they can't have any derivative, so they must be constant. Because there's no such thing as a minus one form, this tells us that the zeroth cohomology consists of constant functions. This is or as the constant function. So it's actually easy to see. If I'm on some other manifold, a zero form is closed if it's constant, or at least locally constant, because the condition is going to be that all of its partial derivatives vanish. So on any manifold, or any connected manifold, it's also. Let's look at H1.
We consider the dimension equal to 1, right?
Yeah, the dimension is equal to 1. That's the first, the zeroth Betti number is 1. So on H1 of the wheels, so the condition of being closed is trivial because there are no two forms. So this is a set of things like this. Right, we get rid of those g's, which are our derivatives. Because the Durham operator from zero forms to one forms stands, we write this, df dx. Stands f to df dx dx. So it's just functions modulo those functions which are derivative. Now we can, that's, but every function on the real line is a derivative of something because we can write down an antiderivative. So g of x is equal to d by dx of the integral from naught x g of y y. So the first cohomology vanishes because every function has an antiderivative. So we've determined that the only non-zero cohomology group for the reals is just the zeroth one that consists of the constant function.
Can you just, maybe I'm not seeing the condition they're mapping here. That we are saying we identify those forms which whose difference is a derivative.
Yes. Oh, so they're saying like I'm identifying g with zero, g minus zero is a derivative.
Yeah. So, but we need to identify not only zero, right? We need to identify all such functions, right?
Yes. Well, you could say like this. So g 1 minus g2, so g1 is equivalent to g2 if g1 minus g2 is a derivative. But g1 minus g2 is always a derivative because I just take the integral of g1 minus g2.
So g1 minus g2 is always a derivative. So we identify all.
Exactly. But I think the better way to think about it is like we're identifying every g with 0. So since everything is equivalent to zero, there's only one.
Okay, got
it. So hopefully, this gives you a hint as to why it wasn't going to be. Why sometimes there is cohomology, because sometimes you might not be able to perform the antiderivative.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether we could talk a bit more about the geometric interpretation of the Betti number.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, but it's I wanted to give more details on that once we said a little bit about integration. I was hoping to do that soon. But the geometric interpretation is roughly HK is something you can integrate over k-dimensional submanifolds. So the kth cohomology group measures whether there's interesting k-dimensional submanifolds that can't be collapsed to a point. But I think we'll have a better understanding of that once we do Stokes' theorem. And hopefully you will. The next example will give you some geometric understanding too. So what happens to the circle? Well, zero forms. This is functions of theta, which are periodic. One forms the same thing, f of theta d theta, call this g. G of theta plus 2 pi is equal to g of theta. Let's compute the Durham operator. So there's two ways you might approach this. We can use Fourier analysis, or we can use this kind of picture here. So I'll first do it in this picture. So if I have a zero form, then d of f theta is equal to 0 if and only if f is constant. So h0 of s1 is equal to r.
But it should also be periodic, right? Or any constant.
Any constant function is periodic. How about H1? So if I have g of theta d theta, then just like in the case of the wheels, g is equivalent to 0 in cohomology. If it has a periodic antiderivative. So let's check this. Let's write down the antiderivative. E of theta is equal to integral. The phi is not the theta. D phi phi. Okay, so you might think, okay, I've written every one form as D of a zero form. But the problem is the thing here inside these brackets might not be periodic. So can you guys see the condition that will guarantee that it's periodic?
If the difference be a constant, it's hard to make it, right? Because it's derivative of alpha theta, which is not periodic.
If the difference
of two functions be a constant.
Uh-huh.
They are not in the same class because the difference, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's correct. But there's another kind of maybe more geometric way of saying it, which is like, this is periodic. Well, its value when theta is 0 is 0. So the value when theta is 2 pi must also be 0. So it's periodic if and only if the integral of g vanishes. So the example you were saying, a constant function has non-zero integral. So the antiderivative cannot be periodic.
But the only example is a constant, right? It's one-dimensional.
Well, yes, because I can take any function and I can add a constant to it, the constant being its integral, so that the integral vanishes. So anything differs from the constant by something its integral vanishes. So I wanted to write it like this, though, because you want to get the intuition that I suggested above is that the non-zero cohomology classes are related to things whose integrals along closed manifolds is non-zero. So you can conclude that the exact one forms are those d theta with zero integral. And so that since any, you can add a constant c d theta to make anything have zero integral. You find that the first cohomology group of the circle is equal to the wheels, the wheel numbers, and the isomorphism is given by integrating over the circle. So the intuition is that this is true because H1S1 measures closed cycles, closed 1D manifolds. Closed 1D submanifolds of whatever you have. And in this particular case, the circle itself is a closed 1 manifold. That suggests there should be a first cohomology class, and there is.
Isomorphism is given by that. What does that mean?
Okay, so if I have cohomology class, you represent it as a form, mm-hmm. and then you integrate it over the circle to get a number.
Okay,
but that takes an element here, and that works because those forms which are exact get sent to zero. What are we doing? I think the next thing I'd like to do is to discuss briefly what happens on Rn. We're going to need to compute the cohomology groups of something like the two-sphere. We might need some more techniques than we have right now. But the following fact that the cohomology groups of Rn are zero I is bigger than zero. And our or, I is equal to zero. We've already seen this for n equals one, so let's have a look at this for n equals two. I won't give the general proof. Let's check. So in this case, this is a little different because we need to use the closeness condition, which we didn't need to use before because in previous cases there were no two forms. One form is and it's closed. If df one by dx by dx two is equal to d by df2 d by dx1. So then you want to say, we want to show that it's exact. There is some f, capital F, x1, x2. With df dx1 is f1, df dx2 is f2. So probably we won't be able to guess the formula, our A formula for what capital F could be. Maybe this is too much detail, but let me do it quickly. So we define f of x1, x2 by an integral. I'll draw the integral, the origin. Here's x1, x2. Here's x1, 0. So along here, we're going to integrate f1 x1 0 dx1. Along here, we're going to integrate f2 x1 s dx. So we're really just doing a line integral, like a sum of two line integrals. I could have chosen a different path and gotten the same answer. I chose this one. So this is the integral of x1, d0 dt. Plus the integral not x2. F2 x1 ss. And now a little playing around will tell us that when we differentiate this F and use this equation, that we get the right thing. So we want df dx2, this is the easy one. Well, x2 only appears once there, and that's f2 x1 x2, correct? Whereas df dx1 is equal to, well, x1 appears twice, it appears there, f1 x1 0, and it also appears there, plus integral not x2 df2 dx1. Now, hopefully you can see what we need to do. We need to use the equation to translate this into a derivative with respect to s. And then we integrate by parts. And that term will cancel, and I'll pick up f1 on x2. Let me do that up here. You can see.
Maybe we can directly use this equation we had when it is closed, the condition for closed.
Exactly, it's to switch this.
You switch this and then become the total derivative.
Exactly, yeah. Yes, and this is a total derivative. So that's, that term will cancel. And this will be, this is an F1 now. F1, one, two. Okay, so I hope you have some explicit understanding now why vanishing of cohomology is related to the existence of antiderivatives and intervals. So the next, to get a better understanding of cohomology, I wanted to move on to talking about how to integrate on manifolds. But are there any questions before we do that? So I won't have a great deal of time to spend on that right now, but we can get started.
Complete the argument. Here we are saying that we can always find an f that satisfies first thing that given that satisfies that condition, and so a small f that satisfies those conditions, we can always find a capital F.
Exactly.
Therefore, it's trivial that it will still be zero. The okay.
Yeah. So like saying that your one form is exact is like the same thing as saying you can find a capital F satisfying these.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure. So I mean, it's a useful fact to know, right, that given a system of PDEs like this, there is, it's obviously a sufficient condition to provide insights satisfying these, but it's also necessary when you're on a manifold with trivial topology. I said that backwards. It's always necessary, but it's sometimes sufficient.
Yeah.
have a brief start on integration. So we recall if yi, if say if xi, yi are coordinates in the same manifold, then dy1 times dyn is equal to the determinant dyi dxj dx1 times dxn. But so, as I mentioned, this should remind you of the Jacobian factor in integration. When we change variables in integration, we get the absolute value of the determinant. So in order to be able to compare these, we need to be able to use manifolds. Different question or no? We need to be able to use manifolds where the determinant of this matrix associated with coordinate change and its absolute value are the same. The following definition. An orientation on a manifold is a coordinate atlas so that the determinant Lyi Lxj is always positive between any two coordinate patches. So the theorem is going to be on any compact manifold, there's going to be some issue about convergence of an integral, so condition about that. Compact oriented manifold. You can integrate op forms in a coordinate independent way. Okay, so I'll get to that a little bit more next time. Maybe the only thing I wanted to last thing I wanted to point out is sometimes the manifold does not have an orientation. For example, the Möbius band failed to draw properly, and we draw this the other way, where we identified the two sides. Theta is t. As I move from one patch to the other, the coordinate transformations like t goes to minus t, theta to theta plus 2 pi, the Jacobian of this is negative. So you can show that this manifold does not admit any orientation. And I mean, the simplest way to see this is theta wedge dt gets sent to minus d theta, right, dt. When I do the gluing, and that's the prefactor there, and it's okay. So I'll stop there. Yeah.
With the torsion and the Mobius strip show up in the chronologies anyway.
Yes. It's better to. The Mobius strip is not compact. So a better example is the Klein bottle. Where you identify two sides with the same reflection. So it's like theta is still theta plus 2 pi. But there's also, when I glued them together, I sent theta 2 to minus theta 2. Sense? So if you do this example, it's not oriented. That tells you that there's no cohomology class in degree 2. Because a cohomology, typically a two-dimensional manifold, if it's oriented, has a cohomology class in degree 2. Corresponding to integrating forms over it. Just like on the circle, there was a class in H1 corresponding to integrating over the circle. But because we can only integrate over oriented manifolds, that class is only present in oriented manifolds. So on something like the Klein bottle, the second cohomology group will be zero.
Can we think about Mobius as an antiperiodic circle? And the same calculation that we did for circle.
Yeah, you can, but you don't really get anything interesting because these cohomology groups, it's the circle and then there's some kind of interval going off the other direction. But because the cohomology of the interval is so boring, we're not really sensitive to that. Now, another way to say it is the cohomology groups, I could squish the Mobius band down onto a circle. So the cohomology of the circle and the Mobius band is the same, which is why it's better to use something where you can't squish it down onto a circle. This is, topology can't really distinguish the Mobius band in a circle, but it can distinguish the Klein bottle in a circle.